Our Father, thank you for the opportunity to come here tonight to study your word. I pray you'll help us open our minds to the fullness of your word. I pray that we'll be in awe of just how accurate your predictive prophecies are. Help us to understand that the prophecies come from men who don't know the future. Given these prophecies are given to them by you, you know the future because you declared the future. You don't predict it. You declare it. Help us to understand that and to see all these minute details that came about in history. And may we be amazed to know that you're doing the same thing in our time. That things in this world now and in the coming days are going according to plan. And I pray we will learn to rest in your sovereign care. Even as you have cared for us, most importantly, through your Son Jesus Christ, saving us. And we thank you for that. And in Christ's name I pray, amen. All right, Daniel chapter 10, verse 1 through Daniel chapter 11. Verse 45, although I'm trying to remember, I might actually pull up short of that. I think I forgot to change my verse on that. Yes, I did. We'll pull up short of that. We'll go through verse 20-ish. Okay. If, as God's people, as Christians, if God were to send us a prophet who could tell us the basics, maybe in cryptic language and hard to understand language, but the basics of what the future is going to look like for the next, say, 400 years. That would be pretty exciting, wouldn't it? Okay. That's exactly what is happening in the book of Daniel and what we're about to read. And I preface this, even reading of the text with that to help you understand, because we're about to read this and you're going to be like I have been this week. In my studies, you're going to be a little bit overwhelmed, potentially, because there is so much. And I've really debated on, do I include all this history or in the actual fulfillments of how, here's what the prophet said and here's how it was fulfilled. And I thought, you know what? Yeah, we're going to do it because I think it's beneficial to see the sovereignty and the providence of God coming to pass before our very eyes in history. Okay, so and I don't know exactly how I'm going to do this. I think we're going to start with the mainly with the text and then bounce back and forth between the text and the history as it was fulfilled. We'll see how it goes. Okay, so we'll start with Daniel chapter 10, verse 1. And I'm just going to take a few verses at a time kind of a thing. All right. So Daniel 10, verse 1. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a word was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar, and the word was true, and it was a great conflict, and he understood the word and had understanding of the vision. So, verse 1, Cyrus's third year. I gave you guys all the information tonight because there's so many details. I thought I just want you to have it in front of you. Cyrus's third year would have been 536 or 535 B.C., depending on how you calculate it. It's about 2 years after the vision of chapter 9 that we just studied last week. It's also, remember, these visions, even though they're later in the book of Daniel, they're actually going back toward the beginning of the book of Daniel, chronologically speaking. This vision would have come about around the time Daniel went into the lion's den, okay? So, look at verse 2. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 weeks. I ate no delicacies, no meat or wine entered my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all for the full 3 weeks. On the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen with a belt of fine gold from Euphos around his waist. His body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning. His eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sound of his words like the sound of a multitude. And I, Daniel, alone saw the vision, for the men who were with me did not see the vision, but a great trembling fell upon them, and they fled to hide themselves. So I was left alone, and saw this great vision, and no strength was left in me. My radiant appearance was fearfully changed, and I regained no strength. Then I heard the sound of his words, and as I heard the sound of his words, I fell on my face in deep sleep with my face to the ground. So we looked at the setting for the vision there in verse 1. Now we're looking at what we would call, I would call a vision of Christ. Now there is debate among some theologians, not usually Christian theologians, about the identity of this being that we just read about in verses 2 through 9. But most everyone agrees this is Jesus Christ, an apparent, a pre-incarnate appearance of him. First of all, though, in verses 2 and 3, Daniel mourned for 3 weeks with fasting. And he indicates he's distraught. He's really down. He's really struggling. Probably he knows, you know, remember Cyrus has already made the decree that the Jews can return to Jerusalem. It's a little bit of a guess, but probably he's already troubled and worried about some of the Jews going back to Jerusalem and the trouble that they were getting, especially from the Samaritans at the time. And so that's part of the trouble. The trouble what he's always concerned about, have you noticed in Daniel, the book, he's concerned about the future of the people of God. He's worried about their current state and what's going to happen to them down the road. And God continually comes to him, either personally through a vision or through the angels, and reassures him, I've got this. Okay? So, Christ appeared to Daniel, verses 4 through 9. Look at the description there again. I would say this recalls, it should remind you of the appearance of Jesus in Revelation. If you go back and read Revelation 1 and also Revelation 12, this is the way Jesus was dressed, basically. Very similar language. Now, remember, it's all symbolic. Jesus may or may not literally, I'd say, does not literally have flaming eyeballs, right? Any more than he did when he was here on earth. Okay? It's symbolism for the intensity, the purity, the power, the authority, his all-seeingness. All these things are a part of that the imagery. So, it says he's clothed in linen. So linen is white. So purity. With a gold belt. Beryl body. Beryl is a golden colored stone. We think probably is a type of topaz. And so a very goldenish stone. But in this vision, it would be like almost like gold shining versus, say, topaz. But a very bright color. It says his face was like lightning. His eyes like flaming torches, his arms and his legs like burnished bronze that is bright and beautiful. And then his voice sounded like a multitude. You ever go to like a concert or you're in a stadium and you before the show, after the show, you hear this because people are talking, you know, and how much more once the show starts, if it's a concert, people screaming and yelling and it's just that's the sound of a multitude of voices. A crowd of people. Now, Jesus has one voice, but the point is, it's this power, it's this presence, this authority to it, this influence. Daniel, verse 7, Daniel says he alone saw this, but the people who were with him, they didn't see it, but they felt it, so to speak. There was a great trembling so that they hid themselves. They were terrified. Who does this remind you of in the New Testament? Who saw a vision of Jesus Christ, but the people who were with him did not see. It's in the book of Acts. Saul, who became Paul. That's right. And so he sees Christ, this heavenly vision of Christ. I wonder if maybe he saw something similar to this. Maybe the exact same thing for all we know. He never would tell us exactly what he saw. He just said, I saw Christ. All right. But his reaction was similar. Daniel, it says, he became so weak, verse 8, that he fell on his face in a deep sleep when he heard the man's words. If you go to Revelation chapter 1 there, verse 17, John has a similar experience to that. Where he's just, I mean, he says, I fell down like a dead man. Right? And for all our talk and all the world's talk, Christians talk even, for how we want to see Jesus. We just want to see you. We want to know you. Come, Lord Jesus. Sometimes I wonder, do we really mean it? Because when we meet him, there's going to be a little bit of this going on. rightfully so. He's worthy of our just being in awe of him. Okay? So, the next section, vision of a mighty angel, verses 10 through chapter 11, verse 1. Okay? So, this is a little bit longer section. This section I'll read all of it, and we'll slow down on reading when we get to chapter 11 more so. Okay? Verse 10, and behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. This is, and I'll say more about this in a minute. This is probably not Christ here. This is probably an angel. The scene has shifted. Remember, he's passed out, basically. And then he's brought to, I think, by a separate angelic being. Okay? Verse 11, and he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for now I have been sent to you. And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said to me, fear not, Daniel, for the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, but Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, for I was left there with the kings of Persia. And came to your people and came to make you understand what has happened to your people in the latter days. For the vision is for days yet to come. When he had spoken to me according to these words, I turned my face toward the ground and was mute. So he couldn't speak. And behold, one in the likeness of the children of man touched my lips. Then I opened my mouth and spoke. I said to him who stood before me, O my Lord, by reason of the vision, pains have come upon me and I retain no strength. How can my Lord's servant talk with my Lord? For now no strength remains in me. And no breath is left in me. Again, one having the appearance of a man touched me and strengthened me. And he said, O man, greatly loved, fear not. Peace be with you. Be strong and of a good courage. And as he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. Then he said, do you know why I have come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. And when I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of truth. There is none who contends by my side against these except Michael, your prince. Verse 11, chapter 11, verse 1. And as for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And the reason I connected verse 1 to the latter part of chapter 10, remember, there was a time when there were no chapters and verses. These were added later on to help us find things. So when they first put these together and organized this, they probably saw first year of Darius the Mede and thought, oh, this is a new section. And they kind of really mistakenly put it in a new chapter when really it's better suited to the end of chapter 10. Okay, so before I get into this section, notice there's this progression. God keeps reminding Daniel, one, of Babylon and its end, of course, it's already ended by the time of this vision, Persia and what's going to come, Greece and what's going to come, and then there's going to be some other kingdom after that. Have you noticed this has been a repetitive thing? So you've got the statues, you've got the visions, you've got all these things that keep reaffirming how history is going to go. And we know from this side, that's exactly what happened. It was the Persians, the Greeks, and then the Romans, though Romans weren't named per se here. Okay, now, so here's a vision of a mighty angel. Daniel's terrified again, and he's strengthened now at this time by this angel, comforted by him. It's probably Gabriel. The Bible doesn't say that, so, you know, don't throw stones at me if you disagree. We don't know. But it's probably Gabriel, because Gabriel's already dealt with him earlier in the book. Okay, he has come in response to Daniel's prayers for understanding. Daniel prayed. God sends the angel to help him understand what's going on. Now, in verse 13, the prince of Persia. If you go back to chapter 10, verse 13, I'll be in chapter 10 for a while. So if I just say verse 10, verse 13, that's what chapter we're in. 13, the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me. Now, what in the world is going on there? Is this talking about a historical, like the son of a king? Or might we be talking about an angelic being of some kind? Or a demonic being specifically? I think this is talking about a fallen angelic being, a demon of some kind. And there's the evidence for that is the prince of Persia spoken of, and this angel, Gabriel, let's say, is fighting against the prince of Persia. But he needs help because he wants to come to Daniel, but he can't stop fighting the prince of Persia. And so Michael, the archangel, comes to fight. And then Gabriel calls Michael the prince of your people, the prince of Israel, the angel that oversees Israel and guards them and fights for them. So it seems to indicate that this prince of Persia is not a man and it's not an angel, but a fallen angel. It could be Satan himself, because Persia is the most mighty nation on the planet. Who else, what other angel would be so big and bad that God would need, let's say, to send in the best, which is Michael and Gabriel? Were you going to make a comment?
Yeah, if, I mean, if God wanted them to, the angels could go, and if it was just a man, they would
really
take care
of it. Right. Yeah, we see that in the Old Testament where, you know, God wipes out entire armies through the power of his angels, right? So you're absolutely right. So it only makes sense that this is spiritual warfare. This is Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, type warfare. There's a warfare going on in the heavenlies that we don't know. And angels are fighting. We think we're alone in this fight. You know, when we stand up against abortion, when we stand for this right, that right, what is right and wrong, we feel alone as Christians, but we're not alone. In the angelic realm, there's a war going on between the opposing forces. And I think this is a beautiful picture. I think it's beautiful. It is beautiful because God wins no matter what. So it is beautiful, even though it's war. It's a beautiful picture of God taking care of us. So the evil angel withstood Gabriel for 21 days. So let's say this is Satan. He withstood Gabriel for 21 days, but Michael, the archangel, came to help him. Not because Gabriel couldn't take him, I don't think is the idea necessarily, because Gabriel has another job, and that is to go answer Daniel's prayer. Okay, is the idea, I think. Verses 15 through 19. Daniel is again overwhelmed with fear, but comforted as Gabriel comes and says, he says to him, I've got to return to keep fighting the prince of Persia. But he says, don't worry, this battle is going to result in the evil angel of Greece, the prince of Greece coming. And think, what is that, a good thing? Another evil angel? Well, it is, because God raises up kingdoms and brings down kingdoms. So God's going to use his mighty angels to bring down Persia. And he's also going to use wicked men like Greece to bring down Persia and raise up Greece and raise up another prince, if you will, another demonic force that would be influential. And so, what was I going to say? Michael, it says Michael alone would be there to help him. And this almost sounds, again, it almost makes it sound like Gabriel's like, oh, poor Gabriel, he's not strong enough to handle it on his own. I don't think, again, it's not the idea. And I don't think it's the idea of, man, there were no other angels that would come help. Well, they're good angels. If God told them go help them, they'd go. That's not the issue. The issue is, he's saying, Michael alone's with me. Why? Because that's all we're going to need. He's the archangel of God. He can handle it. So the battle to which he's referring is probably began in the first year of Darius the Mede and or Cyrus the Persian, as we see in chapter 11, verse 1. And when I say battle, remember, I'm talking angelic battle in this context. This angelic battle between Michael and the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece and all this stuff going on is probably in that first, is when Persia first comes on the scene. This battle is beginning to take place. But you say, well, I thought the battle was on earth between these. Yes, it's both. I would, based on a lot of this, again, we have to be careful. We don't want to become like some of the kooks out there that are always just studying angels and looking into the, you know, the unknown. And they almost have these secret spiritual powers of what the angels are doing. But here's what I will say. What we see here is, think of a glacier. What we see here when it comes to earthly warfare between good and evil, countries rising and falling, it's just a tip of that iceberg, man. It's just a tip of it. The majority of the battle is outside of this in the spiritual realm, I would argue. I would even argue within the spirit of God's people, there's that unseen part of that battle even in the physical realm. So we're in a spiritual battle. Any questions before I continue on? It's a good pausing break. Okay. So verse 2. We're going to slow down just a little bit for the rest of our time, okay? Chapter 11, verse 2. And now I will show you, the angel speaking, now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. So, there's going to be after Cyrus, there's going to be three more kings, Persian kings, and a fourth. The Bible does that a lot. It's like, why doesn't it just say there's going to be four more kings? Because God is emphasizing what? That fourth king. Okay? That's why. The importance of that fourth king. The others are important as well. I gave them to you here. These were real people. Remember, this has not happened yet. Daniel was prophesying when Cyrus is on the throne, not when these other people have. Yeah, this first one maybe might have known of him because he might have been old enough, but he's not on the throne yet. All this is in the future, okay? So there's Cambius, Smerdis, who may also better be known. Of course, we all know him better as Gamalta, don't we? No, we don't, but history does. Oh, yeah, Gamalta, yeah. No, three is Darius, Hystaspes, Darius the first, and four would be Xerxes the first. And so that fourth one that comes in, historically, the text says stir up Greece. He did. And again, I'm not an expert on all the ins and out of Mediterranean history, okay? So don't grill me on, well, what happened about that? I don't know. I'm just giving you the basics because by the end of this, you're going to be like, basics were enough. Thank you very much. But this guy, he agitated the Greeks. He stirred up trouble with them. And there was turmoil and war and issues between them for a long while because of that, as we'll keep reading about here in a moment. So that's the prophecies about Persia. Then verses 3 and 4 are prophecies about Greece. Verse 3, then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he is arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, so not his son, who was assassinated, of course, nor according to the authority with which he ruled. He was powerful, but these rulers won't be nearly as powerful as he was. For his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others beside these. So who is this? Who is that Greek king whose kingdom, when he died, fell into the hands of his four generals? Alexander the Great. You say, man, are we going to cover this again? Yeah, we are, because Daniel's covering it again. God apparently thinks this is really important to Daniel and the future of the people of Israel, right? And so we know this mighty king is Alexander the Great, back side of the sheet. And then the four Greek kingdoms that will follow headed up by these Greek generals. They'll be great, but not as great as Alexander the Great's kingdom and his rule. And just won't measure up. All right, then verses 5 through 20. We're not going to read all those at once. We're going to go real slow because there's a lot of details that I'm still trying to put together myself, to be honest. Okay? And I followed closely the timeline or in the headings in one of the commentaries I've been using because it was so helpful. I thought, you know what? If it's helping me, it'll help you too. To kind of see, okay, here's what's going on. Okay? So, then in verses 5 through 20, you have prophecies about Egypt and Syria. Now, it gets tricky because Egypt is the Ptolemaic dynasty at this time. So, that section, that one of the four kingdoms from Greece was the Ptolemaic kingdom in the south, Egypt south. Think Egypt south of Israel, and that'll help you, okay? So Ptolemaic, Egypt south. And then you have the Syriac or the Syrian. Syrian is probably a better way of saying it. The, up Syria, up north. Okay. Also known as the Seleucid Empire. And they're named after their first rulers, Ptolemy and Seleucus. So, verse 5 is about Ptolemy the first Soter and Seleucus the first Nicator. Verse 5. Then the king of the south, so that's Ptolemy, shall be strong, but one of his princes, that is Seleucus, even though he's in the north, don't let that confuse you yet, but one of his princes, Seleucus, shall be stronger than he, and he shall rule, and his authority shall be a great authority. So here's what happened. The king of the south, Ptolemy, was very strong. One of his commanders, Seleucus, served underneath him and served with him, but he ended up becoming a little more prominent. And there's a lot of history going on. Some of it I remember, some I don't. But he ended up regaining portions of the northern kingdom, the Seleucus kingdom, the Seleucid kingdom. And so that's what this verse is talking about. That came to pass. Now, the Bible didn't give the names of these men, but look how close. And again, it's a little bit cryptic, symbolic language, but yet there's also some literal stuff going on there, too. It's really interesting. Really amazing, if you think about it. Verse 6. Ptolemy the second and Philadelphus and Antiochus the second Theos. After some years, they shall make an alliance. So that's the north and the south. Southern kingdoms, if you will. And the daughter of the king of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the strength of her arm, and he and his arm shall not endure, but she shall be given up and her attendants, he who fathered her and he who supported her in those times. So, what's going on here? What literally happened? How was this prophecy literally fulfilled? The southern and the northern kingdoms have been fighting for years. So, the Ptolemaic and the Seleucid kingdoms fighting for years. And finally, they come to this agreement. Ptolemy II says, here, I'm going to give my daughter, Berenice, from the south, to marry Antiochus II up in the north. We're going to get a treaty here together through marriage. In this, so her son was to become, so once they had a son together, the son was to become the Seleucid king in the north. But the problem was Antiochus II was already married, already had a wife, and his wife, Laodice, murdered him and Berenice and the child. That's exactly, again, the Bible doesn't come out with specifics of names, but look how close that is, right? It's telling us what's going to happen before it ever happened. It's prophecy. It came about in real history. So then what's going to happen? Verses 7 through 9. Ptolemy the third, Euergetes, and Seleucus the second, Callionicus. I don't know if I'm pronouncing these correct or not, but maybe they're close. Verse 7. And from a branch and from her roots, so that's going back to Berenice. You remember she's been killed. And from a branch, from her roots, one shall arise in his place. He shall come against the army and enter the fortress of the king of the north, and he shall deal with them and shall prevail. Don't want to stop there. Yes, I do. So one from a branch of her roots refers to Berenice's brother, Ptolemy the third, who was the next ruler to come in the south. He comes to power. He's connected to her. Part of the branch, right? He comes to power, and in retaliation for his sister's murder, he attacks and defeats Syria, Seleucid kingdom in the north. Just like the Bible seems to be indicating, right? Yeah. Next section, verses 10 through 19. There's more details there we won't get into. Verses 10 through 19. Antiochus the third, and the many the conflicts he came into with Ptolemy the fourth, Philopator, and Ptolemy the fifth, Epiphanes. Verse 10. His sons shall wage war and assemble a multitude of great forces, which shall keep coming and overflow and pass through, and again shall carry the war as far as his fortress. Then the king, I'll make sure I stop where I need to. Okay. Then the king of the south, moved with rage, shall come out and fight against the king of the north, and he shall raise a great multitude, but it shall be given into his hand. And when the multitude is taken away, his heart shall be exalted, and he shall cast down tens of thousands, but he shall not prevail. For the king of the north shall again raise a multitude greater than the first, and after some years he shall come on with a great army and abundant supplies. In those times many shall rise against the king of the south, and the violent among your own people, that's Israel. The violent among your own people shall lift themselves up in order to fulfill the vision, but they shall fail. Then the king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand, but he who comes against him shall do as he wills, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land, Israel, with the destruction in his hand. He shall set his face to come with the strength of his whole kingdom, and he shall bring terms of agreement, and perform them. He shall give him the daughter of women to destroy the kingdom, but it shall not stand or be to his advantage. Afterward, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall capture many of them, but a commander shall put an end to his insolence. Indeed, he shall turn his insolence back upon him. Then he shall turn his face back toward the fortresses of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. Now, that's a lot. A lot. Let's look at the sheet and try to work through it. How did this work out in real history? What is this? How did this prophecy come about? How was it fulfilled? Well, Seleucus II died. His sons continued his war. Verse 10, even as far as the king of the south's fortress. That really happened. Ptolemy IV responded with a successful counterattack. Verse 11, that happened. He counterattacked. And he got pretty, he thought himself pretty proud. He got pretty proud of himself. He got proud in his heart. History records that he thought, hey, he was encouraged by his victory. He's like, hey, I can do this now, right? He was exalted in pride, so he led further attacks, verse 12, that were initially successful. Tens of thousands of people were killed. He was a mighty warrior, a mighty leader, and his armies were victorious, and it looked really promising. But verse 13 says that Seleucid kingdom would be dominant. It would ultimately fail, verse 12, because the Seleucid kingdom in the north would prevail, would become dominant. And that's exactly what happened. It looked good, looked promising, but then things went bad. And this was actually the door, because what did I title the lesson? I forgot to even say, setting the stage for Christ's first advent. All these things are setting up the chessboard. God is setting up the chessboard for Christ to come. And when we come back in August, we'll talk about Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, and how that set up the chessboard even more to get Christ here, okay? But we're already seeing the beginnings of the chessboard being set up. God is moving leaders and kingdoms and armies where he wants them to be in order to pave the way for his son to come into the world, okay? So about 15 years after this, Antiochus III successfully defeated the newly crowned Ptolemy V, verse 13. Then, in verse 14, we hear about these, let's see if I can read. In those times, many shall rise against the king of the south and the violent among your own people. It's saying many are going to rise and attack Egypt. They're going to go south and attack. And one of the most well-known people to go into Egypt and do this was Philip of Macedon. And it says, along with the violent of your people. That means Jewish rebels who were like, yeah, some of them lived there. Some of them maybe came in and invaded as well. But they joined in thinking this is the way to go. They were part of this persistent attack, but it failed ultimately, according to the text, and it did in history. But Antiochus III successfully gained complete control of the Ptolemaic kingdom, the southern kingdom. Verses 15 through 16. The Jews in Jerusalem thought it was great. Antiochus III has been victorious. Remember, Israel's stuck in between, right? Israel's mostly more a part of the, was earlier on, the Seleucid kingdom in the north, mostly. But they're caught in between, just like they are today, by the way, right? Between all these nations that are just going crazy over them. And it's, nothing's really changed in a lot of ways. Nonetheless, so they're caught in the middle. And they think, hey, Antiochus III, he's kind of like a savior to us. This is great. This is a great thing. But what does verse 16 say? But he who comes, Antiochus III, against him shall do as he wills, and none shall stand before him. And he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his hand. This is a prophecy that though the Jews are going to be like, "Woo, we're so glad he's here," it's going to open the door to something very terrible. Because I presume his grandson, because he had a son rule in between them, Antiochus IV is going to come, and the persecution was awful. The thousands and thousands of Jews that died were slaughtered by him and by his armies, his people. It was terrible, terrible time. If you've never read the first and second Maccabees, you can read parts of the history of how that happened and some of the things that took place. Now, so this would happen about 23 years after this greeting. They literally, it's reported that they cheered and they welcomed him into Jerusalem when he came. About 23 years later, they were wishing he never set foot there. So, Antiochus III, next paragraph, forced terms of agreement on the Ptolemaic king, the Egyptian king. To seal the agreement, he gave his daughter, here's a name we know in history, Cleopatra, to Ptolemy V in marriage. But this move failed because Cleopatra loved her husband and gave support to the Ptolemaic efforts. Verse 18 tells us that. Cleopatra thought she was her own woman. And she was, and you know, from a human standpoint, Cleopatra didn't know that God was using her to fulfill his word. That's cool. Yeah. Now, so Antiochus III attempted to conquer the coastlands, verse 18 says, but he was stopped. Now, verse 18 doesn't say it was the Romans. It doesn't give their name. But we know from history it was the Romans. Do you see how God, again, is setting the chessboard up for this Messiah to come? Because it will be under the rule of the Romans as a kingdom that Christ will enter into the world through what's called the Pax Romana. Remember what that stands for? You Latin, Roman peace, the peace of Rome. It was outstanding time. That doesn't mean it was perfect. Of course not. They had trouble and issues still. But it was a peaceful time, by and large, in the Roman Empire. It was a great time for the gospel to come and to be able to spread rapidly among the people. Now, so the Romans come and they stop them, and they even lost territory to the Romans. So the Romans are beginning to have some supremacy in the region. Okay? And that's going to grow. It's going to take time. But I mean, we're talking 191, 188 B.C. I can't remember, some of you history buffs, when did Julius Caesar, when did he take the throne? Does anybody remember? Carolyn, you're good with, you can't remember? Oh, yeah. Thanks a lot, Carolyn. I thought I could depend on you. Yeah, but I want to say, was it, what, 146 was it? Anyway, I don't know. I didn't look that up for this study. I apologize. Nonetheless, we're getting closer and closer to these events. So he returned to Syria defeated, where he was killed by a mob, an angry mob, in 187 BC because he tried to plunder the temple of Zeus. And the reason why he tried to get money or something to trade for money, whatever the case, but to steal the temple treasure in order to pay off the Romans. The Romans put them under an exaction of repayment. war repayment type thing, indemnities, you might want to call it that. Some people will call it that. And I think it was like 1,000, I may have it written later on, I can't remember, 1,000 pieces of whatever the money was, silver, whatever it was. And he didn't have it. And so they tried to go get it from the Temple of Zeus, and the people weren't having it, right? Okay. Last but not least, verse 20. Seleucus the fourth Philopator. Okay. Verse 20. Then shall arise in his place one who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days he shall be broken neither in anger nor in battle. And I know that looks like we're stopping in the middle of a paragraph. We kind of are, but the next section gets into Antiochus the fourth, and we want to save that because, as you can tell, this is plenty for tonight, don't you think? That's a lot. This is a lot. And so Seleucus the fourth was the son of Antiochus the third. He sent a tax collector whose name was Heliodorus to collect the Roman repayment funds. Second Maccabees tells us that he also sent Heliodorus to plunder the temple in Jerusalem. Now, there's First and Second Maccabees are not scripture, so we can't say for sure that all these miracles they record really happened. They may or may not have. I mean, God can do miracles outside of his word. I don't have problems acknowledging that. But they say in Second Maccabees that they went to plunder the temple, but there was an appearance of angels that guarded them from doing so. And so that's pretty cool, you know. God can do that if he chooses to. I've heard stories of missionaries having encounters, or at least the people who wish to do the missionaries harm encountering angels protecting the missionaries. I don't have a problem believing that. I think we said this early in the book of Daniel. I don't just believe in, hey, I have a guardian angel. I think we got hundreds, if not thousands, of guardian angels. God's angels are with us and around us. We see the evidence of this spiritual warfare taking place, and God's taking care of us in ways that we wouldn't even realize. So, Seleucus the fifth only reigned a very short time. He did not die. He did not die at the hands of an angry mob. Verse 20. So he sends this in the exactor of tribute. Historically, that happened within a few days, short time. Could literally mean a few years. He shall be broken, but not in anger nor in battle. Not killed by an angry mob like his dad, and not dying in war, trying to defeat the enemy. How did he die? He was poisoned to death. Heliodorus, his IRS agent, wanted the throne, probably, is the idea. Poisoned him, and it is possible, historically, we can't say for sure, that Antiochus the fourth had a hand in helping him make that happen. Which, when we get to know Antiochus the fourth a little more come August, it won't surprise you that he would try to poison the king and do that sort of thing. He was a wicked, wicked man. Many would say, and I think I agree, that Antiochus the fourth is basically the Old Testament version of the Antichrist. In fact, most scholars, no matter what their view on the end times, would say Antiochus the fourth is, he was so wicked and so terrible because he was, in fact, a foreshadow of the end times Antichrist. That kind of makes sense to me, that God would do that. Say, here, you think this is bad and evil, there's something else coming. Just like, hey, you think Joseph is wonderful? And he saved his people out of Egypt in famine? Well, there's something more wonderful. Christ is coming. See? And so that just kind of makes sense to me that God would do that. Okay. Any questions? I know that's a lot of history. But I can't apologize for that because the text is a lot of history. It's prophecy that if we're going to understand how it came true, we have to deal with the history. And I know it's a lot. But do you guys have any questions or thoughts about it? Yeah.
You said the description of Christ. Do you see most of that as kind of exaggeration or description? Like, what do you call that?
Symbolism or figurative language?
I always thought that was literal.
Sure.
And because he got cast out. So
Yeah.
Focus.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, yeah, I really
feel
something.
Yeah. Well, let me clarify. Let me clarify what I meant and see if this helps. And you may still disagree. I don't know. But in the vision of Jesus, yes. He literally saw Christ with flaming eyes. Literally, he literally saw that. But what I meant was Jesus doesn't, in